TCL is a proud sponsor of the 1500 ESPN Studios. TCL, America's fastest growing TV brand.
Raised on basketball. Raised in front of a computer screen. Raised for covering the game. Raised by Wolves. Now talking all things Timberwolves, the Raised by Wolves podcast.
All right, another edition of Raised by Wolves here on, can I say it? Can I just say it now? Score North. Judd Zolgad, should we say it now?
Actually, it's really cool because it's a time continuous thing, right? Because it's going to start, like, if you tune this, if you listen to this podcast on Monday, it's 1500 ESPN. But if you listen on Tuesday, it's Score North.
It's Score North, yeah. So
anyway. Who knows? Sure, ahead. Go say it. I don't care.
And this
it's your guys' podcast.
This podcast, this one will probably be a little less controversial than the last one we did, I would have to guess.
Oh, no. You know why? I hate Tibbs, too. He made life hell for everybody at Target Center. No, I'm going all in. I'm taking Jim Pete's alley-oop, and I'm dunking. That man made life miserable for everyone.
That is the voice of Judd Zolgad that you hear, by the way, co-host of Mackie and Judd. Judd's Hockey Show, right? That's the podcast with Lindsay and Declan.
Really original name right now for our podcast.
But we're going to talk some Wolves here, and all three of us were at the game Friday against the Dallas Mavericks, and we all got a first-hand look at Luka Doncic. And Judd, I know you're a hockey guy, but you embrace basketball and everything too, and just your takeaways from this young phenom, the Slovenian phenom that just took over Target Center on an exciting night.
As Danny can tell you, because we were right next to each other at the press table, I sat there mouth agape in awe. I'm going to compare it to my sport. He's 19. He looked to me like when the first time I saw Sidney Crosby play live or Gretzky play live, and it wasn't his scoring ability that stopped me. I mean, that's impressive and that's great and fine. 19 years old and you've got that vision of the court, that completely stopped me. And it reminded me of great centers in hockey, because that is completely a God-given talent.
And Jed, I think what made it even better is not that your jaw was constantly on the table inside Target Center, but that you were wearing a suit while this was happening. So you were just entirely out of character at a basketball game wearing a suit with your jaw just on the table. It was remarkable. And I think one of the more impressive things to me anyway, and I'm pretty sure you feel this way as well about Luka, is that he doesn't look physically dominant. Like, he doesn't
look... I said that to you.
I know.
He sort of looks unimpressively human.
Like, he looks like you or I, but a little bit taller. Like, he is taller than the average human, but he doesn't look like a LeBron James did coming out of high school, mm-hmm. or a Kevin Garnett did coming out of high school when they were 19 years old playing in the NBA. He looks normal, and he's incredible. It's unbelievable.
He's not chiseled at all. His shorts look like mine when I put my basketball shorts on around my house, basically. They're sort of drooping.
He wore nicer socks, though.
He wore way nicer socks and nicer shoes, too. But the point is, this is as glad as I've been that I've gone to a regular season sporting event in a long time. And I knew this kid was good. I had no clue. Like, I expected, it's going to be fun to see him. By the end of that game, I don't care if the Wolves won, lost, which they did. I don't care if it was a great game or not. It was a really fun game. Watching that kid play, I said to myself, I am glad I came here just to see him.
Doesn't that kind of shed a light on where the NBA is at, though, too? Where, I mean, and it's been like this forever, but it kind of shows you that at the end of the day, if you go to a game, you want to see your home team win.
Yes.
But the entertainment value that a visiting player can bring, the box office appeal that a Kobe Bryant, a LeBron James, a Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, those guys can bring as an opposing player is just as much of a draw as, you know, watching your own team play.
And the style of game now, too.
Yeah.
Cunningham doesn't know this, but Danny, you are a very fortunate person. Because Manny and me and guys like us, we've loved our sports for a long time. But I'm going to tell you right now, the 90s were hell in hockey and basketball. I mean, there was a lot of bad product.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that NBA and professional hockey have never been in as good a shape on the ice or court as they are right now. And it's not just star players, because there's always been star players. It's the way that they're allowed to play. And as I said, at 19 years old, to watch this kid play in that league in a man's game was really, really fun. And again, though, it's another sign of where this league is at as far as the quality of the product on the floor is really, really high.
It's so great right now to be an NBA fan because it's, like you said, the quality is, it's through the roof. This is, in my opinion, this is the best era the NBA has ever had. I don't think that when Jordan was with the Bulls, yes, he was incredible and those teams were dominant, but I don't think the talent league-wide was nearly what it is right now. And that's a great thing for the league. I can't speak in terms of hockey, so I'll take your word
there. It's the same type of deal, though. Pace of flow of play now in both leagues is fantastic.
Well, and
they're allowed to play.
And the NBA is embracing math, too, for the most part. I mean, Tibbs wasn't here, and I think that – and I wrote about that for today, that I think it's going to change a little bit here in Minnesota. But teams are shooting three-pointers. They're like, hey, three's worth more than two. Like, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yes.
And then getting back to Friday, because before we abandon that game, I want to ask you, what did you think of the environment around Ryan Saunders' first home game? Because that was the reason you went to that game. You didn't go to that game because Luka Doncic was there. That was an added bonus. You went because, hey, the coach isn't going to get booed.
I wrote this. That game was a 20-point win for the Wolves from a business standpoint.
Oh, easily.
They lost the game. Who cares? Yeah. That game... It felt like the weight of the world was off that building. Ethan Casson, the guy, the CEO, business operations of the Wolves, who walked in and fired Tibbs the Sunday before that, was yucking it up with people. Derrick Rose came over to him before the game and gave him the chest bump thing. The fans were happy. The players were happy. That game was an enormous win. And it's just remarkable. And it's so Wolves-like. That in retrospect now, you realize the year that their 13-year non-playoff run finally came to an end, it was miserable. And I didn't realize, I knew it was miserable, but I couldn't quantify it until Friday night. And I said, my God, it was worse than I thought. Fans, executives, players, everybody was miserable. And to have the specter of Jimmy Butler and Tibbs gone is an enormous win for this franchise. Now going forward, of course, don't screw it up.
I just thought it was refreshing that after they introduced Saunders, they didn't have to blast music to drown out Booth.
People were
that was the first
people
game.
He's a likable kid,
very much so.
And I like the fact that you know what he is very clear in that there's a lot of things he doesn't know, which I love. He's very clear in that he's not entirely comfortable. He shouldn't be 32, right? So I mean,
you're learning on the job still.
Yeah, there's nothing. The problem with Tibbs is Tibbs was who Tibbs was, but it was also this. I'm a football coach, gruff exterior. I know what I'm doing when
Duffness.
He doesn't. Yeah, exactly. And it was all just, it wasn't an act, but it was. But I love the fact that Ryan, and you know what, too? Ryan is not trying to be flip. When Ryan comes out and talks about having a practice where they penalize guys who shoot long twos, his dad would have fined him for, his dad loved the long two. I love the fact that this kid is going to be genuinely, as long as he has this job, who he is, and people in the state are going to embrace it. And Target Center, I believe now, is going to be a place where people seek tickets again rather than saying, I don't want to go see that jackass.
Danny did tell me, too, after Tibbs was fired off the air, he told me that it was going to be time eventually for me to retire my Tibbs voice. So I'm not going to be able to go around saying, playing hard for 48 minutes.
No, you can now. More than ever.
More than ever?
You're Tibbs' new job. Commenting on the Timberwolves unraised by Wolves. This is a coup.
Do you think we could get Tibbs on to respond to Jim Pete?
That's what I'm saying. You've got him. Tom, you know, that Jim Pete stuff was very unfair. Your response to that.
Just got to play hard. Just got to keep grinding hard for 48 minutes.
You know what?
Got to have a lot
thing?
Of toughness.
You know what the really sad thing is? Every time Tibbs got booed at home, which is not healthy, normal, he would get this like sort of evil grin, like,
yeah.
I bet he put the Jim Pete pod in, got a glass of wine and a big steak, and thought, this is exactly what I wanted to do. This was my, if one person was miserable, my life is made.
Well, I remember you talking about when we were doing Mackie and Judd back when the infamous Jimmy practice happened. You said this multiple times that Tibbs probably loved it, that he probably just sat back when Jimmy was going around, you know, mother effing people and screaming at people and that Tibbs was just sitting back, just smiling and probably enjoying every minute of it.
Tibbs thought things were good and healthy that were truly sort of sick.
He lit a competitive fire. That's what he thought Jimmy Butler did that day. He thought Jimmy Butler brought a competitive fire to that team that had been missing throughout training camp.
Just think about that for a second. We had a coach and player in this town briefly, but both in this town, who were as destructive as two people could possibly get. That was a marriage made in hell. And they loved it. But no, but seriously, I know, we've seen that, right? Those marriages where you're like, you two people are sick. And they're like, ah, oh, but we've been together for 20 years because we love it. That was them.
Now, the Wolves don't have an illustrious history by any stretch of the imagination. But is the Jimmy Butler, Tom Thibodeau era the worst in franchise history?
Oh, Manny can tell you equivocally no way.
Yeah, there were some.
David Kahn. And you guys don't go back as far as I do, but I was there for the first ever game at the Metrodome, second deck, right field side against the Bulls. And I mean, you transition to.
Hang on, the fact that you said right field side for a basketball game is hilarious.
It was the right field.
I know, but it's hilarious.
Oh, yeah, the future wife and I were in the right field, basically bleachers, $3. The players were ants, but it's Jordan, so who cares, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, Mussie was here for a couple years and actually tried to win. Incredibly destructive. Jimmy Rogers, the hot assistant from Boston, came in. Just awful. There have been, Danny, I would say this. The Tibbs-Butler era together, brief time, is probably the most destructive, and it was bad for the franchise. But as far as being flat-out bad, uh-uh. Because keep in mind, you made the playoffs.
Yeah.
David Kahn, everything he did.
Woo, it was bad. Exactly. I've said on numerous occasions that David Kahn was the worst sports executive in the history of sports. Everything, the only thing he did right.
This Cleveland Browns fan might have something to say about
that. Yeah, that's true.
Did you see what Sashi Brown did to my team?
analytics.
And
analytics.
Ray Farmer. My team had a GM suspended for texting down to the sidelines to put Johnny Manziel in the game. I'm not sure that we're going to agree on this.
So you guys got a fight between David Kahn and Ray Farmer.
Yeah, we'll have to have a little debate on that. But I will say the only good thing that David Kahn did that was right was he drafted Ricky Rubio at 5 in his first draft. But that was – he was lucky because he wasn't even anticipating Ricky being available at 5. He thought Sacramento or somebody was going to take him ahead of him, and then Ricky just fell there at 5, and then he had no choice at that point because of, you know, where he was in the draft. But then, of course, he followed that up with a pick later taking Johnny Flynn, which completely nullified everything. What is your thought now, Judd, on what we're looking for with this team now the rest of the season with Ryan Saunders? Because Danny and I have talked about, winning and losing is kind of secondary here. It just more seems like how the team looks. Even you go back to Friday's game, okay, they lost the game, so what? But you saw they played very well, and they kept themselves in that game, even though Luka is beasting on them for pretty much start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's not. I don't really look at this as, well, they got 42 games left and Ryan Saunders has to win 23 of them in order to. This just seems more like a feel type of thing if he's going to keep this job and have the interim tag removed.
Oh, I agree completely. And I think that if we sit here and assume that Ryan's not going to get the full-time job, that's a mistake. I think he might. But here's my conundrum, or here's my problem. Who's running the show from a basketball smart standpoint? Scott Layden's not going to survive, right? He's going to be fired. He has to be fired. This makes no sense to keep him. If you're going to bring in Chauncey Billups, for instance, as your GM, then I don't want to tell Chauncey that you've got to take a certain guy as his coach. I think the smart play is long-term, is to hire a GM, a good one this time, by the way, and then if he likes Ryan and keeps him, that's fine. But I also think the only thing I will say from a player standpoint that I'm looking for is if Ryan could continue to maximize effort from Andrew, and I think you actually, in this case, there's one player I would consult with, Kat. Kat's your franchise.
Absolutely.
Kat's your superstar. Kat is the type of player who the rest of this town's teams lack. I mean, this is a potential generational superstar.
I mean, the Vikings have Kirk Cousins.
Hey, where's Matthew Collar? Hey, Matthew Collar, you want to talk about code words? So between all of that, I believe that the most important thing, though, is let's see how Ryan does in maximizing what he can get from players. If players like him, which I do believe that they will, but it's a tricky question because I would be loath to have Glenn Taylor try to hire a GM and say, Ryan is the guy. I think you have to say, you need to consider him, but he is, I'm not going to stick you with anything because this franchise, we've learned, needs a GM and a coach, separate jobs going forward, and that GM has to have total control of basketball ops so Glenn, again, doesn't have to step in.
Where is your level of trust for Glenn to get that right?
Oh, extremely low.
That's the problem.
But you know what? As I told Phil, guys, one of these times, doesn't he just sort of have to luck himself into a good decision? I mean, David Kahn is a lot of sins go away there because, my God, you can't do that again, right? And you're not going to David Stern or Silver and say, who do you think I should hire next? Chauncey Billups sounds like he makes a ton of sense. As far as I know, this guy's extremely basketball smart. He would be new at the job, but that does not preclude you in 2019 from being successful at the job, right? So at some point, I think Glenn has to get some luck too. And
Chauncey has a previous connection to the organization. If Glenn's looking for somebody like that, then, hey.
Yeah, exactly. And if Chauncey wasn't right there, I would say this might be tough. But Chauncey's right there. Chauncey seems like a pretty good choice. And the other thing that this does, and it might be a small thing to some, but to me it's a big thing, is this potentially gets KG's foot back in the door, not to run the franchise, not to own it, to just be associated with it. The Timberwolves need to make their next hire somebody who will stop them from being a laughingstock. And I think that firing Tibbs goes towards that. But, you know, Chauncey Billups brings instant credibility. If KG comes back and says, I hate Glenn, but not that much now, all of those things could go a long way towards giving your franchise credibility. And this franchise has consistently lacked it for years.
Thank you, sir. That was fun.
Thank you. That was great.
Judd Zolgad. Find him on Mackie and Judd with Rami and various other aspects, Purple Podcast, and Judd's Hockey Show as well, all on scorenorth.com and 1500ESPN.com until it becomes full-fledged.
It redirects you.
Yeah, it's going to redirect you, yeah.
So. Go read our stuff. Yeah. Listen to our stuff.
All right, joining us on Raised by Wolves now, he covers the Philadelphia 76ers for The Athletic in Philadelphia. Derek Bodner is with us. Derek, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Let's just get right into this. We had you on the last time we spoke. We had you on right after the Wolves Sixers trade, where Jimmy Butler goes to Philadelphia and Covington and Šarić come over here to Minnesota. From your perspective, how has the Jimmy Butler era, even though it's still very young in Philadelphia, how has that gone? How are the fans viewing it? How has Jimmy sort of fit in with the culture in Philadelphia? Just from your perspective, how are things looking over there?
So I think on the court, it's probably been about what you would expect. You know, I think there are some concerns offensively in terms of the fit when all three are on the court. But I think when you start staggering them, and the Sixers like to stagger their stars as much as anybody, you know, they've really shown individually. And I think when all three of them are healthy, they're something like 18-7, 19-7, so they're winning games. But, you know, there's a little bit of figuring out how to balance all three of those stars offensively when they're on the court together, specifically when Butler and Embiid are on the court. Butler's been a little more of a role player when he's been on the court with Embiid. But more importantly, and this is probably going to come as a shock to nobody listening to you guys, it is the off the court. It is the worrying about everybody getting their own shots. It is the locker room dynamics, which are right now probably the biggest concern, and which will be their biggest concern for the rest of the season.
Now, we all heard back here about the meeting with Brett Brown where he kind of blew up in a film session. How big of a deal truly was that? Was it maybe overplayed a little bit? I know they tried to downplay it when it was brought to light, but was that something that could maybe stick around and be detrimental to them down the road?
Yeah, so, I mean, could it be detrimental? I think everybody thinks it could end up being detrimental. I mean, Butler has a history of it becoming detrimental. And it's never, with Jimmy, it seems like it's never one incident. It's the cumulative effect of incidents over a period of time. So is that one specific incident a huge deal? Probably not. Like, Brett Brown is pretty, you know, he's pretty well adapted to handle that. Like, he has a type of personality where I think he can see through an incident. You know, to me, the biggest concern is somebody that was in that room, in that film session, thought it was an incident. And it's not the first time it's happened. It won't be the last time it happened. And who saw that was really troubled by it and told ESPN about it? And is that somebody who you're worried about is going to be, you know, concerned about it long term? It is very much a concern. It is very much in Jimmy's past history. Is that one incident an issue? Probably not. But when you look at that one incident and you project out, will this continue to be a problem? That's where the concern comes in.
How do you fix it? I mean, what would be the best course of action to, you know, just sort of rectify some of the, you know, if there are any chemistry issues? And I mean, and just specifically on the floor, like, how can they sort of get things going the right way to where they can keep everybody happy and engaged? And because the ultimate goal for them is they all want to win, obviously, and they're still a very good basketball team. But just the on the court chemistry things, what can they do to sort of get that in a better direction?
Yeah, I mean, so I think on the court, the first thing is, you know, Butler was pretty clear that he's not a fan. The Sixers like to run a lot of dribble handoffs, almost in place of pick and rolls. Butler isn't a huge fan of that. He prefers to be put in a middle pick and roll. So at the first step is doing that, placating him in that regard. The question becomes, though, is Jimmy Butler unhappy because he's not in more pick and rolls, or is Jimmy Butler unhappy because that's just sort of how he operates? And that same kind of mentality that took him from that, you know, overlooked kid in Texas to where he is now is sort of the same one that's going to, you know, get in his way in terms of fitting into a team dynamic. So the first step is placating his current concerns. I do think it is staggering their stars as much as possible, because the Sixers are always going to run a large chunk of their offense through Joel Embiid, and Jimmy Butler isn't the most, you know, he passes up a lot of open perimeter jump shots because he wants to create off the dribble. So I think staggering them, and I think getting them to really buy in. You know, the Sixers, Brett Brown recently said this, where Sixers have the most wins in the NBA from, you know, Christmas 2017 until now, or at least that was true as of a week ago. And the Sixers, with all three, or with their starting lineup on the floor, was, you know, one of the best lineups in the NBA. So you convince them that, look, you are going to have to sacrifice your role a little bit in order to succeed. And the question comes down to, is everybody in that locker room okay with that? And I think they're really looking at these next few months as a way to, you know, figure that out and figure out that personality dynamic.
How concerned is the franchise that all of these issues continue to bubble, that one, there could either be a blow up, or two, Jimmy walks this summer when he is a free agent and he doesn't stay in Philadelphia and sign for that 5 years, and it ends up that the Sixers lost both Robert Covington and Dario Saric, and now Jimmy Butler's gone too?
Yeah, I mean, those are both certainly pretty big concerns. And the one, what the Sixers can take solace in is that if that happens, if Butler walks, they will have upwards of $50 million to spend in free agency below the salary cap. And you start off with a working point of Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons, you know, 50-plus wins, and $50 million, you should be able to get some depth. Will it be Jimmy Butler? No. Could you get a Robert Covington? Could you replace Robert Covington? Probably. It won't be on as good of a contract, and that's part of the reason why Covington was so valuable in trade. But you can get a role player or two like that where you can recover a little bit. And I think right now the Sixers are probably a little more concerned of, let's evaluate Jimmy Butler. Let's evaluate him on the court. Let's evaluate how we think he's going to age over the next 5 years and how we think he can be handled in the locker room, and make sure that we're comfortable with that contract we're going to have to give him over the summer. Because I do think they have a way to pivot in free agency if they determine that Butler's not the fit, or if Butler determines that Philadelphia isn't the fit for him.
What would you say is the biggest weakness on the roster as a whole right now in terms of just depth or shooting or any of those types of things that, you know, do they have anything that they can, you know, make a move or something like that before the trade deadline to sort of put themselves in a better position to go on a run deep in the playoffs?
Oh, I mean, their depth is far and away the biggest issue. And that's why, for as much as we talk about how do these three big pieces fit, and that's important because you're talking about that being your core going forward, right now their depth, I mean, they're giving regular rotation minutes to players like Jonah Bolden, Landry Shamet, Furkan Korkmaz, all rookies and all very incomplete players. They have 5 through 10. They really, if you look at any playoff team, they probably have the worst depth of any playoff team. So fixing that, getting some players that you can really rely on in the postseason. In terms of perimeter defense, you know, they have really three players who you can rely on defensively, and that's Embiid, Simmons, and Butler. And everyone outside of that's a real liability who can be really hunted and switched and attacked. And those are their two. If you ask me, it's specifically perimeter defense, but depth overall are their two biggest weaknesses.
How impressive is it to get to watch Joel Embiid on a nightly basis now? I mean, when he came into the league and was injured all the time, he was more of just a guy that sure had potential, but he was fun on Twitter and social media and all this stuff. But now he is undisputably one of the two best centers in the NBA. Just how impressive is he on a regular basis?
No, he's very impressive. And just the, you know, they ran him off of Iverson cuts the other day where he's sprinting across screens throughout, you know, baseline to baseline. And it looked completely natural for a 7'2", 280, 290-pound human being to be doing that. And just the fact that he can do that and maintain his balance and have that speed and have that coordination. And then also he can go down low and dominate people inside, and he can be one of the two or three best defensive players in the league. There's very few things on the basketball court Joel Embiid can't do, and even less that if you project that over a couple of years of skill development that he won't get to. I mean, when the Sixers, back when he was making his debut in 2016-17, we had a meeting with Brett Brown. He came out and he said, look, we're running our offense through him. He's going to be who we go to in the clutch late in games. He compared him to Shaq with soccer feet. And that sounded absolutely absurd at the time. But as you've seen him progress, I've never seen anybody improve as quickly as Embiid has. And he's one of the most well-rounded players I've seen.
We're talking with Derek Bodner, who covers the 76ers for The Athletic in Philadelphia. And Derek, I love Ben Simmons. I'm a big fan of Ben Simmons. I'm worried about that jump shot though, man. And I'm worried that he's never going to really develop that. And I feel like that's one thing that's going to hold him back. But it's one of those things where if he figures that out, just to finds a way to get just at least a respectable jump shot to where people have to at times at least account for it, then he's going to be as unstoppable a force in this league as you'll find for years to come. But you know, where is he at with that, and is that ever gonna kind of come into fruition for him?
Yeah, one of my colleagues over at The Athletic, Danny LaRue, he compared it to being a Monet with a huge ink spot in the corner that you just can't take your eyes off of, and you've got this painting that's, you know, just picturesque and perfect and a work of art. But there's an imperfection that you just can't get past. And that is a lot of what you see with Ben Simmons. He really is, in terms of what he can do in transition. He's developing his post-up game. Defensive versatility, he's, you know, I won't say one of the best in the league, but he's an incredibly versatile defender. He has a lot that he can offer, but he needs that jump shot to reach his full potential, and especially to reach his full potential alongside Ben Simmons, or alongside Joel Embiid on the basketball court. But I think part of the problem we're seeing when all three of them are together is that Jimmy Butler wants to run a pick and roll. But what do you do with Ben Simmons off the ball? And they try to put him under the rim for lobs and catches, and he ends up just gumming up the paint. They can't put him on the perimeter because nobody's going to defend him out there. And I think the most important thing for him to develop right now isn't even a jump shot off the dribble. It's a jump shot from the corner. If he could just get a catch-and-shoot corner three, the half-court offense between these three becomes much easier. But in terms of, do I think that's likely to happen, at least at a 30%-plus clip on a decent volume, I don't know. To be honest, from what I saw of him in high school, I think he was a better jump shooter back then than he is now. So for him to make so little progress over these, you know, 3-plus years, it's concerning. And, you know, he worked out with his brother, who's a basketball coach, a legit basketball coach. But he worked out with his brother over the offseason on fixing that, and you wonder if maybe he needed somebody who would push him a little bit harder, who would, you know, sort of get in his face and challenge him maybe more than a family member would. You wonder if maybe he needs a new shooting coach. I don't know, but whatever he's been doing, and I think he's been working on it, it just hasn't resulted in you know, actionable game jump shots.
At any point this year, will he hit a three-pointer?
I mean, could there be a heave, maybe? will it be an actual legitimate three-pointer? I don't think so.
How much, last thing before we let you go, how much are Covington and Sharage missed over there, just from a fan standpoint? Because I know both of them were pretty well-liked by the fan base over there. How much are they missed?
Oh, they're certainly missed. Dario was a fan favorite. I mean, you've seen Dario. How can you not enjoy watching Dario Saric as a human being? And Robert Covington was really big in that locker room. He was really big in terms of setting a defensive mindset and sort of being a clubhouse leader defensively along with Embiid. And I think right now they don't, for as good as Jimmy Butler is defensively, I think they miss some of the havoc Covington could provide. And I think the way he could defend, you know, even out on the perimeter, even point guards, which they don't really have anything to cover right now. They're missed very much. Covington was a little bit divisive because he could be a little bit streaky in terms of his outside shot. And the rest of his offensive game never really, you know, he doesn't have enough moves off the dribble to compensate for when he's struggling from the perimeter. But defensively, he brought it every night. And Philadelphia's a fan base that appreciates that. The Sixers are a team that needed that. And I think both of them are missed quite a bit.
Awesome stuff, Derek, and thanks for joining. And we'll catch up with you again when the Wolves play the Sixers here in late March. We'll have to catch up with you again. We appreciate the time.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right, that's Derek Bodner. He covers the Philadelphia 76ers for The Athletic. And awesome stuff as the Wolves are taking on the Sixers later this week. In fact, tomorrow, Tuesday. So thanks to Derek for joining us. Thanks for thanks to Judge Zolgad for hanging out with us for a little bit. Lots of great conversation going on there as well. You can find this podcast on various different outlets, iTunes, Podcast One, 1500ESPN.com, ScoreNorth.com as well. I'm Manny Hill for Danny Cunningham. Follow Danny on Twitter at RealDCunningham. Follow me at Manny Hill. 84. Thanks for listening to Raised by Wolves, and we'll talk to you next time.